Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is April 7th, 2016. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Events, we've got lunch with Richard Dolan on April 30 in New York City. We got, I think, 4 tickets left, so absolutely jump in there and get your ticket if you want to come. I think we're going to do a lunch in Sydney, Australia in May, and I will keep you posted by email if we decide to go ahead with that. It'll be simple and a la carte. You'll be free to bring your guests if you're down under. Under the category of there's always something, we've shifted the launch of our new website into May. We want a very smooth transition, and it's very complicated. So it means more tweaks and testing, which will take us into May. But again, I can't wait for you to see that. I think you're really going to be pleased. Our theme tonight is about the Panama Papers, and it's called Weaponizing the Data Beast. I have a lot to say on this topic. We've gotten a tremendous number of questions over the last week, so you're clearly very interested in it. I think it's a very important story. But I have a lot to say and a lot of little snippets and pieces and stories to gather together because we're just at the beginning, and this is going to unravel and unfold for a while here. And it could go in a lot of different directions. My title, Weaponizing the Data Beast, is a term of art that we used to use at Hamilton Securities, my company in Washington. And it was inspired by the comment from Nicholas Negroponte, the head of the MIT Media Lab, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. Whenever we would gather databases that had very powerful information on large amounts of money, these wars would occur, the data wars, and I'd say, the data beast has landed. And we've seen the data beast weaponized with the Panama Papers. And the data wars are upon us globally. Not that they haven't been for a while, but this takes it to a new level. As I said, it's going to take a long time to see where this goes, and I want to cover a group of questions and issues. And part of it is not just because of the Panama Papers, but because this use of the data beast and weaponizing the data beast is going to be with us for quite some time. WikiLeaks made an interesting comment. I retweeted it this week. They said, if you censor more than 99% of the documents, you're engaged in 1% journalism by definition, which I thought was very cute because if you look at the initial data dump and then how much is being disclosed, there's a great deal that's not being disclosed. And so the disclosure is very selective. If I had to guess as to who's responsible, I suspect there's a very good chance that the groups who targeted Hamilton Securities are very much a part of the Panama Papers, essentially a CIA-centric operation, U.S. intelligence agency operation. It could be run entirely by the defense contractors, but ultimately it reports to the deep state, if you will. Okay, first some background stories. I first ran into the Soros interest. Soros is one of the funders for the his Open Society Foundation is one of the funders for the Center for Public Integrity, which is the holding company essentially for the affiliate that's launched the Panama Papers. It's a global consortium of journalists. But ultimately, it looks like the Center for Public Integrity has taken it under its umbrella and is running the website. I first ran into Soros when my company was targeted within short order, and the Department of Justice seized our offices. We finally got it back, but they had literally, with an incredible and intense smear campaign and all sorts of false allegations, had made it impossible for us to function as a business, so I shut the business down. And it didn't take very long until a sort of inside player who knew me showed up suggesting that I repackage everything that I was doing and take it to Soros and get a grant and do it as a not-for-profit. And I looked at him like he was nuts. Here's what he was saying, because at the time Soros was on the executive committee on the Council on Foreign Relations, And I knew exactly what that meant. I was thinking, oh, great. You basically steal my business. You steal my contracts. You strip my company of all the people. You seize the databases. You steal the software tools. You steal the data. You use that to make financial equity for yourself. And then you take a tiny piece of it and you keep me busy engaged in some not-for-profit thing that goes no place under the auspices begging for money of one of the perpetrators. Are you crazy? Do you really think I'm that stupid? Anyway, I've watched many different uses for foundations and sort of what's called NGOs. And I have always encouraged you to watch the Norm Dot interview with Ed Griffith, marvelous interview on sort of how the foundations are used. There's also some great examples in Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, sort of about how foundations are used in disaster capitalism. But needless to say, this kind of philanthropy, in my experience, is used to help the pro-centralization team in a whole variety of ways. You could write an encyclopedia about the different ways. So there's no doubt that Soros and that network is present here, just as they were in the Hamilton Securities case. Okay, the second story I wanted to tell you is why I refused to go to Panama. When I was litigating and trying to look for a low-cost place to live, I can't tell you how many people, again, insiders who suddenly showed up and said, oh, you should go to Panama. Well, if you look deeply into Panama, which I did, Panama is very much a stronghold of, at that time, it was kind of the CIA and the Bushies. The first Bush administration had invaded Panama, kicked out Noriega, who'd been on the CIA payroll for a long time. And if they didn't control it before, after December 20th, 1989, when the invasion took place, they sure controlled it afterwards. And I realized in pretty short order, oh, if you look at the people on my tail here in this country, if I went to Panama, it'd be that much easier for them to get me. And that's why I always tell people, be very careful about getting away, because you have institutional and cultural protections here that you might not have in foreign lands where you're a stranger. I suspect if I'd gone to Panama, I probably wouldn't be here doing the Salieri Report today. So Panama is a very kind of interesting place. But a very big banking center and one of the strongest growing economies in Latin America. The Center for Public Integrity was founded by a guy named Charles Lewis, who I have great respect for, and it's tried. He and the Center for, and he's now retired or not active, I think, at the center. But if you look at what he tried to do and his successors and the organization, they've tried to do a lot of great things. But I think over time, the establishment and the funding, the rules of funding, have constantly pushed them in ways that marginalize them. And I wanted to tell you a story of one of the first times I saw them marginalized. I went, they had announced that they were doing a big project on transparency globally. And of course, I think the key to real solutions is transparency. So I thought, oh, great, the Center for Public Integrity is going to help do transparency. This is wonderful. I can give them all my place-based financial statement things. So I headed over to a big press event they were doing, and it was either at Brookings or Carnegie, somewhere over in one of the big places in Washington, big think tanks. And they had a very impressive woman leading the whole thing, and they'd done a whole methodology and done all these calculations and ranked this and that and interviewed millions of or thousands of reporters all around the world and editors, and you know, it was a big process and a big research, and where it came out was the United States had the best transparency in the world. It was completely Orwellian, and what you realized is this was a person working entirely in the official reality who was clueless about the whole covert reality or how the money worked, let alone, you know, the covert cash flows. And there was an audience of about 100 people. It was a very global audience with people from all around the world, and everyone was stunned, and no one said anything, and there were almost no questions because it was so bad. You didn't even know what to say, but you realized that, you know, the people doing this were completely clueless. And as such, you know, it's basically George Soros funding the proof positive that America's perfect. Every place else is corrupt. It wasn't quite that bad, but almost. Okay, so a few stories from the from what I learned being the target of a smear campaign, not unlike what's happening to some of the people who find themselves targeted through the Panama Papers. The goal of the targeting in a case like Hamilton, or many of the cases you're looking at coming out of the Panama Papers, is the goal is to do irreparable damage and destruction before the target has a legitimate or professional opportunity to address allegations in either a court of law or the court of popular opinion. So you basically want to destroy them and steal whatever you're out to steal before they can do anything about it. It's basically the opposite of the law. Of course, the our legal system is based on the principle that an individual or an entity should have the opportunity to address allegations before irreparable harm is done. Well, the goal here is to flip that on its head and do the opposite. And essentially, Mr. Global wants the general population to support this effort to do irreparable harm to whoever Mr. Global targets or has the corporate media target. And that way, Mr. Global gets complete economic control at a very low cost. It's very efficient. So if you can just point to somebody and make up any allegation, and that will do irreparable harm, and the general population will make sure that it does, wow, what an economic system. And so everyone has to live in terror because the law du jour is whatever the corporate media says it is. And the allegation du jour is capable of destruction, whether it's true or not. It took me 11 years and $6 million to prove it was a phony frame. In fact, it was a series of phony frames. When the first phony frame didn't work, they kept trying to come up with other phony frames. But I'll give you an example of how powerful it is, and because it's very hard to understand until you experience it perfectly, personally. I had a chief financial officer at Hamilton Securities, absolutely excellent. I was when we looked for a chief financial officer, I bought way above what we could afford or really deserve because we wanted to grow. So I wanted somebody of really extraordinary caliber. Anyway, and he was. And one day when we were being smeared for money laundering, and I was being the allegations or intimations was that I was laundering money, he said to me, he came up to me and he said, "Could I talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." So we went into the boardroom and he said to me, "You know, I woke up this morning and I said, maybe she is laundering money. I mean, all these people are saying she's laundering money. Maybe she is." And then I realized, you know, you don't sign any checks. Two people have to sign a check, one of which was him. So he signed all the checks. He said, "I control your bank accounts. I control your 401k. I control all the money at the company. You don't sign anything." And then I realized, no, she can't be laundering money unless I'm doing it. And I know I'm not doing it. But it was remarkable. We also had a system where all the cash flows were available to all the full-time employees who were shareholders through the internet. So there was no, you know, there was full disclosure of how the money worked inside the firm with a wide number of people. And I think it was one of the reasons we survived. But it will show you the power of when they turn that machinery on, of how people believe the most ridiculous things. If the machine says it's true, then oh, it must be true. And I used to have to regularly fight with newspapers saying, "Look, this is false and I can prove it. You have to retract it." And they would say, "Well, we're not going to. Too bad. Sue us." And in one case we did, but it gets expensive. It was amazing because if you look at the lengths they kept, they went to keep me from going to trial. So this idea of you get a chance to address the allegations in a court of law before irreparable harm is done. Well, we were attacked by wave after wave after wave from 1996 to it took me until 2003 to get into court to really address the full allegations, and it went through to 2004. So 2003 to 2004, And every time I insisted, they would try and force me to settle. I wouldn't settle. I'd get poisoned. My car would be followed. They'd break into the house. You know, anything to pressure me to settle. And I refused to because I wanted to go into court and make them come to the table and have to put forward evidence of wrongdoing. And it was amazing because we finally got into court. They canceled the first trial where they had to address all the big allegations. They canceled the trial on the eve of trial 3 or 4 times. It was unbelievable. So the lawyers had to keep preparing. It was very expensive. And so finally, we finally got to the point where it was too embarrassing. I wouldn't settle and they couldn't cancel anymore. And so we walked into court. And it turned out, as I had told my attorneys all along for many, many, many years at that point, what was it, 4 plus 8, so 7 years, my attorney turned to me and said, "Oh my God, they have nothing. This was a bluff from the beginning." And I said, "I told you." And he was stunned. He couldn't believe that anyone could bluff with so many allegations and so many lies for so many years, in force. But they can. And it's quite phenomenal to watch it happen. Anyway, so that's why when you watch these things, you want to be very, very careful. Because until somebody has an opportunity to really address allegations in a reasonable way, don't necessarily believe it. Okay, so let's talk about what's happening. There is a line between a leak and a digital break-in and theft and an act of war. A leak is typically not a felony if a government is breaking the law. It's often not a criminal act to leak. But this is something different because this was a private law firm. And what happened was a break-in and theft. Now, if you broke into a fur company, stole 1,000 mink coats, and then reporters all over the world were walking around in stolen mink coats, a policeman's, Interpol would come and take all the coats back, right? So that's not happening here. We've had a break-in, we've had a felony, we've had a criminal act, a theft, and the fruits of that theft have been given to reporters all over the world, and they're free to use them and publish them. It's quite remarkable. Where's the enforcement? Where's the law? So this is a break-in and theft, and it's translating into that material being used in weaponized ways, including as an act of war. I would say that what is happening with targeting Putin and people around Putin, that's an act of war. You are trying to destroy and sabotage leaders of another country as part of a political act. And so that's one of the reasons I'm calling this weaponized data. I would note that we saw an article, it's up on the website. The FBI director bragged about his ability to spy on cell phones. Let me read it to you. FBI Director James Comey said the agency purchased a tool from a private party to access data on the iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino shooters. Now, a private party is selling the FBI a tool that will allow it to hack phones. Why is the FBI purchasing it from them? Why isn't the FBI enforcing against them? You've got a company out there selling tools that allow you to hack into private phone calls and private materials. Where's the enforcement here? Let me keep going. Comey, in address at Kenyon College in Ohio, said the legal battle between the U.S. government and Apple ended because the government has purchased from a private party a way to get into that phone running iOS 9 operating system. He said the same method could be used to help the agency and law enforcement nationwide in the future. Really, I wonder how that tool is helping the private party and all the people they're selling it to. I can imagine a world where a local police department, in a case they can't otherwise solve, can send us a device with the understanding that we are never going to testify, we're never going to be able to tell you how we opened it, so you're never going to be able to use what's on the phone as evidence, but it might lead to something that would be useful, he said. Needless to say, what he's telling you is there is no privacy and there is no law about privacy. Anyway, it's, we are now facing a situation with complete digital lawlessness. So we're legitimizing a crime, which is hacking and stealing a law firm's data. And we're calling it whistleblowing when, in fact, many of the people in that database and their private documents and their privacy rights have been completely trampled. And as far as we know, there may be many of them who haven't broken any law whatsoever. So stealing and destroying other people's privacy rights is not whistleblowing. It's something else. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that. John McAfee, who's running for president on the Libertarians ticket, said a good thing the other day. He said, without privacy, there is no freedom. And what you see is a group of essentially NGO-type players and media entities encouraging the general population to support the complete lawless devastation of thousands of people's privacy rights on private transactions with their private money. Now, some of you may say, well, there's a lot of shenanigans going on that's going to be illuminated by this. And yeah, there probably are a lot of shenanigans. But I just remind you, if the law doesn't protect everybody, then it protects no one. One of my favorite quotes I wanted to read to you again, it comes from A Man for All Seasons, and it's a dialogue between William Roper and Sir Thomas More. Roper says, so now you give the devil the benefit of the law? And Sir Thomas More says, yes. What would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil? William Roper says, yes, I'd cut down every law in England to do that. Sir Thomas More, oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper, the laws all being flat? This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast, man's law, not God's. And if you cut them down and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of the law for my own safety's sake. So if this law firm and its clients don't have a right to privacy laws, and we as a general population respect and affirm and support the destruction of their privacy rights, what do you think that's going to translate in terms of what can happen to us and our banking relationships and our relationships and financial institutions and our privacy? So the process is affirming also the complete lack of systems integrity. We are looking at a level of lawlessness in the systems, which is quite remarkable, given that you've got the whole consumer industry running around and planning on distributing everything through the digital systems. Another aspect of this is targeting enemies. So far, we've seen the Prime Minister of Iceland forced to resign. So one of the few people who, or the few politicians in the world, who successfully stood up to the international banking cartel and managed to issue the first sovereign cryptocurrency, the Aurora coin, has now been targeted and destroyed. How interesting is that? So, and of course, we see the effort to go after Putin and a variety of the sort of New World Order hit list. So expect more of that, but don't for a minute think that the guys are getting targeted are necessarily the bad guys. We're also seeing a competition for business here. There's a great piece in Bloomberg recently about the number one tax haven in the world is the United States. There was a great cover of Bloomberg Business Week, Reno, the biggest little tax haven in the world, because Nevada is one of the most important states. Let me just read you a quote from that story. So a lawyer at a Zurich law firm. How ironic, no, how perverse that the U.S., which has been so sanctimonious in its condemnation of Swiss banks, has become the banking secrecy jurisdiction du jour, wrote a lawyer at the Zurich law firm in a recent legal journal, quote, that giant sucking sound you hear, it's the sound of money rushing to the USA, quote. So part of the message here is you want to use Wyoming, Nevada, and South Dakota. You don't want to use Panama. So there's definitely a market share angle. Okay, the next possible angle, which I think is very important, is blackmail. And blackmailing, first and foremost, the 99% in the database who haven't found their way into the headlines. And there could be enormous angles in both the U.S. presidential campaign and all sorts of business deals going down. But this gives you the power to bring tremendous blackmail to bear if a person was associated in any way with deals with that law firm or was a client of the law firm. Another part of this blackmail is not, it doesn't have anything to do with people who could be directly blackmailed. You have to understand that every law firm on the planet is now living in a state of terror after watching this. If you're a managing partner or the head of systems at a law firm, this experience is putting you in a state of complete fear. Because I assure you, whoever hacked the Panamanian law firm can hack just about any law firm in the world. We suddenly see, and I've been getting the mailings, cybersecurity firms announcing all of their services and saying, you don't want this happening to you. And so one of the things that's going to happen is this is going to help the cybersecurity services, including those who are part of the investment net, part of the investment syndicates around the people who did this. But imagine if you want a law firm to do something for you or not do something for you. You know, your ability to threaten them with this happening to them, it puts every law firm over the barrel and completely obedient to the powers that are doing these kinds of things. So in essence, you're creating a new powerful enforcement network that, you know, it's kind of like the ultimate control files. One of the most important questions of this is which side are the Clintons on? The Clintons have a history with Promise Software and these kinds of networks. If you haven't read the story of or the history of Promise Software, PROMIS, I recommend it to you. There's a wonderful book by a fictional book by Michael Thomas, former partner of Lehman Brothers, called Black Money, that gives you a sort of interesting, easy to read pulp fiction description of how the software worked. So, you know, the Clintons could be on either side of this. Needless to say, the person controlling can do a lot of fundraising. I assure you, if you wanted to raise money for a campaign and you control this database, it would be pretty amazing how much money you could get rolling into your super PACs. The day the Panama Papers hit the front page, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial saying that the real scandal around Clinton's emails was not the emails and the compromise of national security. It was a comparison of the emails to what the Clinton Foundation and the president were doing, running around the world racketeering. And if you read Clinton Cash, I absolutely agree. I think that's true. And my guess is if you dug deep enough into this database and you wanted to connect the dots with both the emails and the sort of the racketeering going on between the two Clintons and the Clinton Foundation, I'm sure you could dig up a lot. So if you wanted to have a major scandal and make sure Hillary Clinton got indicted, you could do it. On the other side, as I said, if you wanted to also raise $1 billion for her, you could also do that. So the question is, who controls the database and what's their goal? And I think we'll see how that plays out one way or the other. It'll be very interesting if it dovetails with the FBI's decision as to whether to indict or not. That should happen sometime in the next 60 days. But whoever controls this database has unbelievable power, not just of the people in the database, but every law firm in the world who's afraid it's going to happen to them, and every offshore financial vehicle who's afraid it's going to happen to them. And, you know, the definite message is going to be, bring your money home back to North America or else. Another symptom of this and another important thing to understand in this is something I've been talking about for several Solari reports now, and we've seen it in the election, and now we're seeing it here on the offshore beat, and that is that the establishment is being re-engineered. Essentially, they're being downsized. People who thought they were insiders are waking up and discovering that they're not, they're outsiders. And I think you're going to see the establishment cut down by a very significant percentage. if you read my, I wrote a commentary about the African-American elite being in a state of shock over the election and sort of facing the prospect of the fact that you didn't need a whole lot of people to put a pretty face on things anymore. Essentially, you could work through the system. You had the central control now, and you didn't need their justifying what was going on. So that means a lot of people in establishment are going to be in a very insecure state for the next couple of years as this goes on. When I've been dealing with government bureaucracies or large financial institutions, I'm hearing more and more paranoia. And it's the clear message is you can't get anything done in 2.0 anymore, whether it's the business bureaucracy or the banking bureaucracy or the government bureaucracy. People are just too scared, and the regulation has gotten way too complicated. What that means is the 3.0 areas are going to be off and running. They're the ones who are getting the most benefit from lawlessness, and that includes fintech. If you haven't taken a look at what fintech means and what it's doing, do a search for fintech and start to educate yourself. It also means surveillance capital is free to roam. So you're going to have a whole bunch of players over in 3.0 who are very good with the systems. And frankly, they're going to profit and are profiting from lawlessness and the ability to act ahead of law and enforcement, because the law and enforcement hasn't caught up with enforcement in the digital space. The Economist pointed out this week on one of their tweets that 1/3 of internet users use Facebook every day. It's just, sometimes I'm glad I'm a Christian, or I would get really depressed. So what do we do if we're going to have to depend on systems that have no privacy and no integrity? I think there's a big question here. Will the Anglo-American leadership of financial system continue in the face of these kinds of dirty tricks? Does it kill the goose that laid the golden egg? Clearly not in the short run. In the short run, cash is pouring in. Where it goes in the long run is anyone's guess. What can you do? Two very important things. First and foremost, please keep redundant and offline records of all your finances, taxes, and other important legal documents. You must be able to prove everything without anything that's online, and you must have copies yourself. So, you know, you can keep them in digital form on a USB stick or, you know, on a CD, but for heaven's sakes, find ways of keeping redundant copies of things in fireproof safes or in safe ways. Do not depend on online sources, and do not depend on the government and financial institutions to provide you with statements when you need them. You're going to have to prove things. If you talk to people who live through disasters, the people who can come up quick are the people who have all their documentation organized and lined up. So that's number one. Please keep redundant and offline records of your financial, legal, and tax documentation. Okay, the second thing, there is no privacy. Let me say it again. There is no privacy. Let me say it again. There is no privacy. And I will tell you how I came to learn how to live in a world where there was no privacy. I was in Washington, and I was living in this beautiful mansion, and another concerned insider came to me to tip me off that I was under 24/7 video surveillance, and they'd hidden video cameras inside my house. For all I know, it was true. I don't know if it was true, but I had to live with the possibility that it was true. And we certainly had 24/7 surveillance and all sorts of 24/7 harassment. And I was contemplating how to adjust to this. And I went to a wonderful sermon at church, and the pastor was all worked up and said, you know, you're worried about what other people think about you, but you need to worry about what God thinks about you. God sees everything you do. God knows everything you do. That's what you need to worry about. And I thought, well, you know, that is what I need to worry about. And if I worry about that, I don't have to worry about all this other stuff. I just need to keep trying to seek total personal integrity. If you look at my opportunity for improvement, it's a lifelong opportunity. And then I just don't need to worry about any of these other folks. And so I really recommend that to you, is to get your mind off of who's invading your business and get your mind on, play offense instead of defense. Get your mind on the source of power and what the source of power that will support you thinks of how you're serving your purpose. So there is no privacy, but there's a way to deal with it, which can take you on a higher mind and get you completely out of the negative space of even worrying about it. Finally, I wanted to read you one paragraph. Peter Apps at Reuters made a very astute comment about the Panama Papers, wrote an editorial. Let me just read you the last paragraph. Even if the new crop of politicians can avoid being implicated in some of the morally uncomfortable dealings revealed by the Panama Papers, that will not itself fix the system. For all its deficiency, the current globalized financial and trading system has helped lift hundreds of millions from poverty in the developing world, even as the wealth gap in almost every individual country has grown. Taming its worst excesses without breaking it entirely will be no easy task. Excellent point, but it's possible, and we're willing for it to work. Okay, money and markets. Markets backed off again. It was looking dire 2 weeks ago, then it was looking pretty last week. Now, the market is not strong, and you can feel it and see it. U.S. dollar index now down 4.22%. The Fed is clearly in a dove position, and from everything we can see, I think they're responding to global concerns, not domestic concerns. And the bond market, the long treasury is now up 10.83%, headed back up. We've seen almost 12% this year so far, but it's dropped back, and now it's coming back up. And the corporate bond aggregate is now up 3.4% for the year. So bonds doing very well. S&P flat, now up 0.5% for the year. German DAX down in dollars, down a little bit more than 11%. The China large caps down 8.19%. The developed markets minus North America down 5.5%. Emerging markets back down. They're now up 1.93% for the year. So still the best performer, but equity is not looking good across the board. The star performer is gold, 16.9%. Silver back down, only up 9.78% for the year. I'm very skeptical. Until we go over the 1340 line, I don't care if it looks glorious right now. I think we could get head faked out again in silver and gold. But I hope I'm wrong. I hope we've seen the bottom. But again, I need to see 1340. CRB, the commodity index, down 5.35%. The commodities are still in the basement. I have consistently been moving my investment strategies to steadily reduce risk. More cash, more high-quality short and intermediate fixed income, and more hedged equity. I want hedges, so I'm not in the mood to tolerate a major correction or drop. I'd rather sacrifice upside if I'm wrong and the equity markets fly. I'd rather lose some of that upside just to make sure I don't take a big down. Again, all signs are the Fed is a dove based on global concerns. Puerto Rico got pushed off the headlines this week because of the Panama Papers. But they have declared a moratorium on debt payments. They're not calling a default, but let me tell you, from a business standpoint, it's a default. They've got $72 billion of municipals, and they're saying they're not paying debt payments. One of the stories behind that is they have significantly underfunded pensions, and conceptually, it's the same challenge we're seeing all over the country. In Illinois, Michigan, which is creditors versus underfunded pensions, who's going to get the money? The pressures on the EU are tremendous. The Netherlands has now voted in a referendum no on the Ukraine deal. And Cameron is under pressure on the Panama Papers. His dad had an offshore investment that he sold in, I believe it was 2011 or 2012. But of course, much hoopla about that while he's trying to promote a vote in June to stay for the UK. to stay in the EU. That's not helping. And then, of course, the neocon bog is my name now for the Middle East, Turkey, Ukraine, the whole mess. As Saker says in a great interview that we published tonight, the neocon bog is heating up. Kerry seems to be, I can't sort out what's really going on, but it is definitely heating up. The Saker says in his interview, the EU will come apart. Same that John Loughlin has said in his interviews with us. So the pressures are clearly up. I think the euro and the fact that everybody is committed and all arrangements are in that currency is going to put huge pressure to keep folks in the EU longer than the Saker or John might think. But I agree, the pressures on the EU to come apart are very significant and growing. Our hero this week is Dr. Greg Corbone, who published a book called Beyond Reason about his son's death at a very young age, and then his journey to try and understand how our reality is really something quite beyond the material reality, something he learned from his son's many talents in the process of going through his death. It's a very slim little book, easy reading, but a remarkable story of a scientist. He's an anesthesiologist, going beyond his training and really trying to understand the invisible realities around us. I, as many of you know, I wrote a commentary on the election called The Kingsman Campaign, where I said that 75, or 20 of my top advisors, people I really look to for input, estimated that 75 to 80% of the popular support for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton came from entrainment technology, subliminal programming, and other kinds of sort of corporate media technologies, mind control technologies, but only 1% of the population realized it. I think Corbyn is on a journey, or his journey is a great example of that 1% and their leadership. Okay, ask Catherine. We got a ton of questions, so I'm going to talk through them. You sent a lot of good links in this week. I wanted to comment on Vax because I got a lot of great links on the documentary Vaxxed about vaccinations that was spiked by Robert De Niro from the Tribeca Film Festival. A theater in New York decided to run, and it's been playing to packed office audiences. One of our subscribers went to see it and says it's fantastic. So if you're near the New York City area, you might want to check that out. But thanks for all the links on Vaxxed. Unbelievable situation. Another interesting one that got sent was a Texas woman died in Cancun while vacationing, went off her balcony. It turned out she worked at the Texas Bullion Exchange. Looks suspicious to me, so I'm posting it. What we're seeing is all sorts of efforts to lock down different pools and pots of gold or companies that deal with gold. The Sprout folks finally moved in on Central Gold Trust, unfortunately. We've seen the purchase of gold money move to a very different control. We use Northwest Territories Mint to make our coins. We just saw last week them thrown into bankruptcy as a result of a judgment in what was essentially a libel case. But again, another sort of unpleasant change of control at a gold company or a precious metals company. Someone also sent in a great picture of a sign from Manhattan Mini Storage that was up on the streets in Manhattan. It says, if Donald Trump really wants to keep all the aliens out, he might as well build a wall around our galaxy too. One question I got was, advice on how to best teach entrepreneurship to kids from K through 12, the person who asked it homeschools. So I wrote an email to Bob Lytan, who I respect, used to run research at the Kauffman Foundation. And that was one of the most serious efforts ever in the world to really drill down and build very high quality knowledge about entrepreneurship and sort of our best intellectual resources on entrepreneurship. A lot of great research done under Bob's during Bob's leadership there. Anyway, he wrote back and he said, "Wow, great question. I don't think there is any good book that addresses K through 12. The best book in general for entrepreneurship for a mass audience is Noam Brodsky and Bo Burlingham's Street Smarts. High schoolers would get it." So I've ordered that, and I'll take a look at it and report back to you. I wanted to remind you again of something I said in several months ago. There was a great study described in the Wall Street Journal about how to make sure your kids were great at finance. It said, don't teach them finance. Just make sure they're absolutely fantastic at math. So math mastery is the door to financial literacy. Catherine, you often speak of the importance of detoxing, and you've made it clear you practice what you preach. I'm wondering what methods of detoxification you use. There are many options. I have a suggestion on how you might respond to my question. If you do not want to reveal too much personal information, invite a guest speaker to the Salieri Report who is an expert on the area of detoxing. Yes, we did that. We did a great Salieri Report with my nutritionist, Dr. Laura Thompson, who is also John Rappaport's wife. And we, it's in the archives. It's a great thing to do, to revisit in the spring. The relevancy of the information doesn't change. It's as useful this year as it was when we recorded it. Anyway, so look up our detoxing archive in the health library with Dr. Laura Thompson. The one addition I could make to all the different things we went through, many of which I use or have used, is every morning and sometimes at night, I will take the juice of two organic lemons and a teaspoon of baking soda and a glass of water, and it's fabulous for staying alkaline and great to keep your liver flushing as well. They keep going. One question about oral or intravenous chelation. I've only used oral chelation, as I discuss in that particular Salieri report. Then they had a question about fluoride. Fluoride, I don't know how to detox, but I will ask. Then they said, I love the last show with a Memphis safe master, never a dull moment with that guy. Yeah, if you're interested in getting a safe, that's a great interview. Hi, Catherine. What is your best advice to one of your subscribers running for Congress next cycle? I would recommend you read my open letter to my congressman that I just wrote to my congressman, Marsha Blackburn, on disclosure of place-based data. I would also say identify the top 10% most value-creating people in terms of local employment and income in your congressional district, and or people, the top 10% in terms of building skills in the area, whether they're businesses or educational establishments. I'd identify them, and then I would figure out what they need, because what the way you're going to make your district great is by helping the real performers, the people who really add the most value, supporting them and helping them get what they need to do what they do. You know, give a value creator a little bit more energy, and it's amazing how they can multiply it. Also, have you considered an interview with Kay Griggs? We posted all of Kay Griggs' interview videos. She was the wife of she's a military wife who does some interviews and tells all about the culture and sort of the dark side of some of the things going on in Washington. I haven't invited her for an interview because I thought the videos and interviews she did were quite complete. So I don't think there was anything I think that she would add. So I would encourage you to watch those. I hear you often on Coast AM and wondered about the problem I found with normal banks and the problem for downsizing and building small like myself who wanted to borrow a small amount for a home in my price range and the problems I found. We need a system that lends to below $60,000 down to $15,000, $10,000 for a small tiny house nation and be able to live small free from zoning issues and government and county issues, a step above camping and being happy with that. I ran into banks saying, no, we do not screw with you over enough with that small alone. Any way you and Dave Ramsey can suggest this or advertise on FYI tiny houses to get the word out, any help and suggestions would be welcome. That's a great idea. From what I can see of federal regulation and zoning, they're going in the opposite direction, trying to make tiny homes very difficult to do. But what you want to do is you want to live in a place, as I do, where there's essentially no zoning. And you're pretty much free to do what you want within reason on your land. I think the way to finance a tiny house is going to be private mortgages. So you're going to have to do shorter amortizations. The private mortgage market developed pretty strongly and really dropped off after 2008 or 2006 to 2008. At the same time, they're always there may be family members or are local people looking for more attractive interest rates. And you have so many people really struggling to get decent yield that a tiny home mortgage is going to be with a 10 to 15 year amortization could be very, very attractive. You just have to be able to carry a much shorter amortization. Dearest Catherine, I was so proud and honored to be a part of Solaria. I'm glad I made the leap and have been following you on Dark Journalists and the Secret Space programs. I work a very physical job and in need of several surgeries, which will force me into a small retirement. I am 64 and a half years old and am being forced from my hometown as a result of high costs. I signed up for a whole life insurance policy. I am in 4 years into a 10-year paid-up status. I feel this is not only draining my wife and I of our resources, but is feeding the tapeworm and looking at life in a negative, death-oriented way. I will probably lose $40,000 if I'm lucky, but better to cut ties because at this high payment a year, I'm still on the hook for a lot. I could then apply this allocation to pay down my mortgage. I may not be around for a whole lot longer. Should I get out of what I now consider an insurance scam? Also, I have the ability to pay off my mortgage and secure the hard asset. I have about this many years left at 3.875% interest. And that would get me out of the tapeworm and help my wife. And some more information. Anyway, I don't know about the particulars. I can't advise you based on the information you gave. If the insurance company has a strong credit, it's a lot more attractive to stay than if it does not. So the credit quality of the insurance company could make a big difference in terms of what would be the best. I'd need to know a lot more about the policy and the particulars to make any kind of judgment on that. At the same time, I will say this: paying off your mortgage in the current environment is very attractive. If you're paying 3.875% mortgage, it's going to be very difficult to get that kind of pre-tax return on most investments, particularly for the near term. So, I just would need to know a lot more to make a judgment. So I really can't without the information. Sorry about that. Dear Catherine, I would love to hear your view about what was going on in this short video. They sent a link to a video of Bill Clinton with Mark Kelly and former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords in Tucson. And it was clear, so the person who asked the question, watch Bill Clinton standing in the background the whole way through. So strange, makes me wonder. He acts slimier in at least another video. I would say that Clinton's health is failing, and I've had other people report this kind of behavior. I think that could pose a serious problem for Hillary Clinton in the campaign, and an even bigger one if she wins, because Clinton's presence has done a lot. He's done a lot to watch her back and make backdoor deals. So if he really, should lose his health or die, it's going to put her in a much weaker position. Hi, Catherine. I'm wondering if we already had I don't even know how to say this, anti-gravity, and T3s and T4s capable of interplanetary and possible interstellar flight, which I believe to be true. Why is Elon Musk still building rockets? It's something that doesn't add up to me. Thanks. This is a great question. I couldn't agree more. It's a very important question. I don't know the answer. One possibility is quarantines on technology. Another possibility, one of our subscribers insists, is all those spaceships that look like they have those technologies are really holograms. So for all I know, they are. But we really do have multiple personality and multiple model worlds. And a perfect example is fossil fuel. We know we have breakthrough energy technology, And yet we're operating on a legacy technology and have been for a long, long time. One of the best speeches I've ever seen that informs this is Farrell's speech on treaty agreements at Secret Space Program 2015. And I would really encourage you to get his presentations at both 2014 and 2015. But that one is, still have to buy it on the internet, but it's absolutely worth getting. Hi, Catherine. I'm a new subscriber to the Soleri Report. I had listened to you for years and finally came to my senses and subscribed. I have to thank you for what you do and for being a beacon of light to turn to. I hope you continue on for a long time doing the great work you do. I wanted to solicit your opinion on my work pension plan option. I understand this disclaimer, you cannot provide formal investment advice, and I should seek out a formal opinion from a qualified advisor. I don't personally trust them or know of anyone I can specifically trust. I've recently switched jobs and have the opportunity to unlock my defined benefit pension plan by taking a commuted value payout or leave it in the current plan. Apparently can roll it over into the plan for his new employer. It's a very good plan and is fully funded at the current time. I have to look 20 to 25 years out. However, I have a very pessimistic view of our public pension plans over the long term and on the state of what our monetary system will be and what our perceived current value of what we have within it will be. For this reason, I lean towards cashing out is worth approximately X. I would incur a large tax hit, but the after-tax proceeds would be in my control. I figure at the very least I'm diversifying my risk, taking it on my shoulders as I will have to be a mandatory participant in the plan again under my new employer. I'm not sure if you can offer an opinion disclaimer side on my situation, my predisposition to want to get out, when I can get out to be under my control. I would appreciate it if you could, but understand you are very busy and will not be able to answer this personal request. I would like, here's some of the important issues. I'd like to have a balance in the system and outside the system. You are probably much better off financially if you leave it in, because it will be able to compound pre-tax for a long, long time. And the power of those numbers, it's worth sitting down and doing a spreadsheet and looking at what happens when that money can compound pre-tax for a long, long time. So I also, my guess about the particular system you're in is it's strong and will probably stay stronger over the long run than you think it will. My guess is I probably will assume greater strength than you will. However, so I like to have some in the system and some out of the system. If you're going to put a lot more into this system and you don't have much out of the system, then it makes sense to take it out, because then you have the money for the worst case. And again, I don't know enough about your situation. If taking it out will allow you to extinguish all mortgage and debt and live debt free, it may be worth giving up that ability to compound pre-tax. So a lot of it depends on other things that are going on. I don't have an information to make a judgment, but again, I believe in balance, some in, some out. And I do think that pre-tax compounding is worth a lot, but I think it's worth more to live debt-free and to be covered in the worst case. Because if you got everything in the system and you hit the worst case, then you're not covered. You don't have assets out under your control. So so I would look for that kind of balance. It would be very tempting if it can get you debt-free. Another comment on, I attended a lecture presentation recently by a gentleman named Matthew Pauly. He spoke about being an unwilling participant in the U.S. Special Forces training program. It was an event put on by Conspiracy Culture. It was chilling and disturbing, and I thought I would bring it to your attention. Matthew was on with Sean Stone and also on Coast with George Norrie recently. I've attached the link. I began to watch the link. I'll try and learn more about Pauly. I don't know much about the story, although I do believe that things such as he's describing happen. I just recorded a show with Jay Dyer, which will run next month, on top movies that describe mind control and describe some of the technology that Pauly was hinting at. So I thought it was very interesting, but I'll have to research more, and I thank you for bringing it to my attention. Catherine, I can't tell you how happy I am with my subscription with you. I've subscribed to many different informational services. Yours by far resonates more than anything I've used to help my knowledge base grow. I'm getting a lot of compliments these 2 weeks. This is very heartening. I love to make sure the subscribers really get value. Okay. Question: in one of your interviews, you mentioned briefly about your QRS unit you use. It was only briefly. Can you speak more on this topic? It's going to be part of my detox and healthy body journey. Take a look at the commentary on the website. It's called Quantron Resonance System. I was given the Quantron Resonance System as a gift, and subsequently, that was in 2004, and it was added tremendously to my sort of preventative health effort, because the stress of the litigation really shut down my metabolism, and it helped me to really kickstart it. The technology, these are my words, help you rebalance your electromagnetic field. If you work a lot with computer technology, it's very helpful. So I like it. I would stress that Dr. Samuel Higgum, who we interviewed on Dirty Electricity, is very negative on using these kinds of things. And so I got a very bad reference from him, but I continued. In fact, I just got a new one. So I love it and couldn't imagine living without it. But check out that website post, Quantron Resonance System. When you buy one, you can get, they have a variety of written material in a book you can buy that will tell you a lot about different ways people have used it. But again, I just find it's great for kind of rebalancing and making sure my metabolism stays high. Oh, this is a great comment. It's not really a question, but a great heads up. Hi, this is hopefully a quick note concerning the question you received a few weeks back about OneCoin. I heard it just yesterday. Somebody asked me about OneCoin. I didn't know anything about it. I'm a subscriber for the last year and very involved in the cryptocurrency decentralization-oriented community for a couple of years now. OneCoin came to my attention at the Tel Aviv Bitcoin Embassy about 2 weeks ago. A flashy-looking man came in and asked about it. We tried to warn him, as we do, about the dangers of what we call altcoins. But then we found out that OneCoin isn't even traded on any cryptocurrency market and doesn't seem to be an actual blockchain-based currency. But as far as we figured from our search, simply a classic Ponzi marketing scheme that uses the new blockchain buzzwords to dupe a new wave of non-tech-savvy people. The man, in retrospect, was someone competently trying to dupe us, which is hilarious. Selling a Ponzi scheme to a Bitcoiner is like selling ice to Eskimos, as I cynically concluded. Oh, this is hysterical. There is no evidence that OneCoin exists at all. See coinmarketcap.com lists all blockchain currencies currently traded, including the most bizarre ones imaginable. OneCoin is not on it. And if a crypto enthusiast is warning you of a scam, be sure you are in trouble. Investing in real blockchain, whatever coins, including the Bitcoin, is problematic enough for several reasons and should never be done without A, reading up and gaining basic knowledge of the concept and mechanism of blockchain-based programs, B, being traded-oriented and aware of the extremely wild and non-fundamentals-based or less politely pump-and-dump nature of these frontier markets. Generally, it should not be done at all. Lots of luck, accepted after much contemplation. Please convey this to your subscriber. I have to tell you, that's great advice. Thank you so much. Big question. Who should I get on the Solari Report to explain blockchain technology? I've been reading books and articles trying to find somebody who would make a good person to talk about blockchain and what its potential impact might be and why. So anything you want to write, I'd love to read. Great comment. So very much appreciated. Dear Catherine and John, this isn't a question. It's a heartfelt, massive thank you. I recently sent you a letter, Catherine, asking you a few questions about spiritual matters. I had to smile wildly to myself when you responded to it on air, as it were, because you said you couldn't really answer all my questions. You actually gave me more answers there and then than I could have hoped for. I then proceeded to go through the interviews that you recommended in the archives that were relevant to the subject alongside devouring many of the John Rappaport posts, I just finished listening to The Power of It. I now have to try and sleep, and my head is an excited whirl of something that I just can't describe. When I first heard you mention biblical references in interviews, I was so intrigued as to what kind of Christian you were. I've developed faith over the years in my own way. I put it in practice, too, and it gets stronger. However, I don't know anybody who I can talk to about it. The only deep conversations I can have is with a handful of my patients. Unfortunately, these conversations always end up hitting uncomfortable walls because inevitably they think you have to do it a certain way, either ask Jesus into your heart or become a Jehovah's Witness or fit into a box. Sometimes I do get insecure and think, what if they are right? What if I'm doing it all wrong and my ego is the thing that is tricking me? Maybe I should be humbling myself in a way I don't realize how to do. I now feel free from these insecurities, and I feel free to carry on as I am. It was so amazing to hear you both discuss your own experiences, and so encouraging, I can't tell you. I feel that by joining Solari, I'm paying a small amount every month to be given a treasure chest, which is overflowing with precious jewels of information. Oh, good. So I'm 3/4 of the way along a springboard. I've been endeavoring to jump off for years, and it has led me to you. I had the most incredible dream this week. So real. A smooth start to finish. One, I've been offered the part of Juliet in a West End production of Romeo and Juliet. As I'm not an actress, this is quite unbelievable, but somehow I knew I could do it. It came with all the excitement they could offer, the people I met, the disbelief that this could have actually happened to me. I experienced feelings in that dream that I've never had in real life. At the last moment, I found out that Romeo's being played by my dream co-actor. Can't think of the right word for it. Anyway, I'm dressed and ready and about to go on stage when I realize I don't know the script. I don't know any of the lines. This is a familiar scenario for me in dreams. Either I'm naked in public, ill-prepared for something, you know. However, the strange thing in this dream was that instead of feeling nervous or running away, I thought to myself, well, God, if you're there, you're going to have to feed me the lines. Then I woke up astounding. Anyway, like I say, thank you doesn't cover it. So excited. By the way, I hope making friends with death doesn't mean that either of you die anytime soon. Stay alive. The world really needs you. Sounds to me like you're going from, you're moving into the phase of realizing, oh, you're inventing it. So you're inventing your world. And as you invent your world, you're inventing the world with the rest of us. We're inventing it. We're writing history. We're part of history. We're inventing history. Some suggestions, some things you might enjoy reading if you like to read. Read the parts that got edited out of the Bible. A lot of the good stuff got edited out. One is the Book of Enoch. Another is the Book of Thomas. I also recommend the Essenes. And I'm a great reader of the Pistis Sophia. And I'm going to another workshop in Italy on the Pistis Sophia in October. So, but it's a journey. As far as I believe, it's never over. I also love to read Rudolf Steiner on Christ and Christianity. He has a lot of great insights. I just finished a 22 CD series of sermons on Proverbs from Tim Keller in New York City. That is one of the best series of sermons I've ever heard. It was the first thing I'd ever heard from this guy. I signed up to follow him on Twitter, and, a wonderful Dr. Mike Linton, wonderful professor in Middle Tennessee, sent them to me. I walked in, and there were 22 CDs stacked up on my den ottoman, and I thought, oh my goodness, Linton is completely over the top. How am I going to listen to 22 sermons on Proverbs? And I tore through it. I just loved it, so it was great. Next question. Love your interviews. Would it be possible to interview George Gilder? He is a master of technology and money. He has a new book, The Scandal of Money, that is receiving rave reviews. I ordered the book, and so I will take a look at it when it comes in, and I'll see. And I very much appreciate that suggestion. I love getting suggestions of great guests for the Solari Report. Dear Catherine, can you tell us about Solari Investment Advisory Services? What it does, and tell us what kind of person would be an ideal candidate to begin utilizing these services. Actually, I would rather not. It's important to keep a wall between the two companies. Solari Report was created to answer clients' questions. I discovered clients were asking me the same question, and I was answering the question 40 times a week, and I realized, no, maybe I should just answer it once and send everybody a podcast. So, anyway, but it was created to answer the client's questions, not to market the investment advisory services. I don't like to cross-market. I just think it brings up serious ethical issues. So if you're interested, I would suggest you contact Solari Advisors, and my assistant can answer and would be happy to answer all of your questions. And I should also say my strategic goal is to grow the Solari Report and slowly reduce Solari Advisors. Dear Catherine, I live in California, and my wife recently took our 12-year-old daughter to visit the doctor. During the visit, the nurse asked our daughter a series of questions, including asking her whether or not we kept weapons in the home. We won't be going back to see this doctor again, but I'm assuming that this information will all be reported to someone and then utilized to categorize specific families. What is your opinion on this? This is exactly what happens when the federal government asserts control over doctor finances, regulation, and ethics. It's very important for you to understand that the data that gets sucked up from your medical records gets integrated with data that's coming in from smart meters, from all sort, you know, from housing and real estate, from taxes. Essentially, everything that comes into the government, in my opinion, is sucked up into the data beast and the ultimate federal data beast that's run by the defense contractor. So the power of that data is not access to the medical or the tax or the financial or the health or the this or the that. It's the integration of all of it and the use of it to harvest for surveillance capitalism, to make money and to control, and for insider trading is what I believe. Anyway, if you see a doctor, I would lay out the ground rules on data beforehand and the privacy ground rules. And you know, the only data you share is what is absolutely on point and pertinent to the reason you're seeing them. I would be very, very careful. I would never leave at this point a minor child with a doctor alone. I would insist on being part of the process. And I think you need to educate your children on their rights so that they don't fall into the trap of being asked invasive questions by doctors, by schools, or anyone. So we're going to have to educate our kids about this. I went to see a new doctor in California several years ago, and it was the most frustrating. The doctor tried to get me to say I was depressed, and I refused to say I was depressed because I wasn't. So they kept saying, well, are you depressed? And after the fourth or fifth time, I started to literally say, how much are you paid as a kickback if you can get me to say I'm depressed? I want to know what the commission is. And then I realized, you know, before I mouth off like that, I should just leave and not come back, which is exactly what I did. The interesting thing was she was clearly very depressed. And it seemed to me if the system had me under the thumb and was making me do things like that, I'd be depressed too. But it's, you know, it's a pretty scary experience. And my heart goes out to you because I know how scary that is. Hi, Catherine. Oh, let me say one other thing. I know you've heard this from me many, many times, but one of the reasons we're all going to have to become our own doctor and find ways to get tested without doctors and find ways of really investing in preventative medicine to make sure that we're healthy and we stay healthy is because you can't trust the system. It's going to become trickier and trickier to navigate it. And frankly, if you live in the area, which I believe this subscriber lives in, you have access to excellent offshore capacity. You know, go south across the border, go, you can go to Latin America, you can go to Mexico, you can go to the Caribbean. But I think it's really time that we all start to access high quality healthcare in areas which are a lot less invasive to our privacy. Hi, Catherine. To summarize, you recently withdraw support from Gold Money, which you had previously recommended for a variety of reasons. Around the same time, Gold Money spawned Big Gold, based in Canada, apparently targeting a different market segment. Apart from some of the concerns you mentioned more recently, Peter Schiff, C-Link, raised some different concerns regarding the potential taxation of holding various forms of digital electronic precious metals like bullion, vault, gold core, hard assets, alliance. E. Dinar, would it be possible for you to please revisit this issue and to give some consideration to this dimension in more recent context and cover that range of subjects in some format? Yes, I will try and look at that when we do the next precious metals report, but I would encourage you to take a look at a piece we did more than a few years ago called A Solari Report, Selected Tax Issues to Consider When Investors Move or Exchange Precious Metals Holdings. It's one of the special reports. You can find it if you go to the special report section at your subscriber resource center, or just do a search on a search engine and you should be able to pick it up. Again, it's tax issues, selected tax issues to consider when investors move or exchange precious metals holding. If you look at the law that relates to Schiff's position on taxability of using gold as a currency, I'm not sure I agree with him, because the law would argue that an exchange of a piece of bullion to a coin at a place like Old Money is not necessarily a taxable event. However, I would note that the IRS could do anything because the digital aspects make it somewhat unique. So I wouldn't necessarily be confident that the existing law would come out the way or that existing tax law would apply. But I will definitely look to talk about that with Franklin when we do the next precious metals market report at the end of May. Hi, Catherine. As in email number one in parallel, I hope you don't mind my presenting some ideas for you to consider covering, especially in regard to Rambus's upcoming report on April 21st. I've rolled up everything you sent and sent it to Rambus, and let's see if it inspires him. Hi, Catherine. In regards to the upcoming luncheon at 21, I thought it'd be a marvelous opportunity to introduce the venue to organic, non-GMO, local food and farmers. And then he gives a wonderful list, or the subscriber gives a wonderful list of all the potential imperfections in the food at the 21 Club last year. It's very funny. I would like to point out we sent, and they recommend going to that down to the Union Square Market in New York, which is absolutely incredible. Just wonderful. I couldn't recommend it more. Anyway, we spent about 20 hours trying to get an organic option for the lunch in New York and finally gave up and went with 21. I'm guilty of compromising because I do love 21. I would say that the chicken that we had from 21 was from the Amish. I know it's not necessarily perfect, but it was one of the best tasting chickens I've ever had. So if anyone has a recommendation for a place to have lunch for 50 where we can get all organic in New York, I would love that. So keep the recommendations coming. Oh, one other question came in last night. I wanted to just read it to you. Is there any truth to this article? I know our world has gotten a bit nutty, but what is all of this about? Can you comment on this for me? I'm really trying to stay grounded and keep a solid foundation in my life. Thanks for your time. Love what you do. If only had a bit of your knowledge, man. I wish you were my next door neighbor and childhood friend. How different my world would be with friends like you. Praying for you often, and love your video visits on YouTube and your Solari website. Here's the link. And it's a link to what I call an adult fairy tale about the global currency reset. I'll never forget sitting with dear friends in June of 2000, right before July 4th of 2014, and them telling me that the dollar was about to collapse and the great dinar valuation was going through, and the currency reset was going through very much like the URL you sent me. And I said, no, in fact, the dollar's going to rise. And they said, no, the dollar's, it's the end. The dollar's going to collapse. Well, in fact, you know, the dollar's up 20 to 25% since then. It's been on this glorious rise. And the great global reset, of course, you know, every week there's just a new reason why it's just delayed, and this is that. Essentially, what you're looking is an adult fairy tale that has bits and pieces that have some authenticity to it. And in fact, the deeper message has authenticity because we know we're watching all the fiat currencies around the world debase, and there's a movement afoot to build and develop a global digital currency. So in one sense, we are going through a global reset, a currency reset, but I would stay away from anything having to say or do with the dinar and any of these things that make life too conveniently simple. So, but I will say this, whether it's the change in the currency or change in technology, we're coming into a period when the change is going to be remarkable and dazzling, and a lot of different institutions and enterprises may not make it. And if you go back and listen to particularly all the wrap-ups for the last couple of years, we go into all of that. And it's part of the shift from the unipolar to a multipolar world. The change is going to be dazzling. So in that sense, we are in a huge global economic and currency reset, but the exact scenario you sent me is something that you can feel free to ignore. Remember, if something puts you into fear, fear is unbelievably dangerous to your health. And so if something puts you into fear, it's not useful. There's no serious financial professional, no financial professional of any integrity is ever going to try and put you into fear, with rare exception. You know, in an emergency, maybe. But if it's putting you into fear, you know, dump it. Let's go to the movies. Our movie is The Big Short, which is a marvelously entertaining, very well done movie. Christian Bale and Brad Pitt, a great cast. It's about the 2006 pump and dump of the housing and mortgage market, specifically the 2006 dump. Of course, there's a huge lie. The implication is that this wasn't engineered with knowledge top down. It was engineered top down. Everyone knew. The implication in the movie is no one said anything. That's ridiculous. The former assistant secretary of housing was speaking in Europe, in London, in New Zealand, was on online radio, was on coast to coast, was just reaching an audience of millions of people. So I, you know, was doing highly successful interviews with Poplov, and they got plastered all over the investors' bulletin boards. My interviews and articles were disseminated widely, globally, in many languages. So a lot of people knew. They just believed the machine would, was going to go until the machine was going to go. And it's very interesting. I knew that they were going to bring the markets down because when they came to settle and the way that they came to settle the litigation, the settlement went through in January 2006, and you could see that somebody had literally blown the whistle at the end of 2005 and basically said, okay, lock this down. And they were running around cleaning up all the liabilities so that they could bring the market down. And it was interesting. My attorney reminded me the other day that I talked at the time about, should we short the market? And I wouldn't have done what the guys in The Big Short did. I would have used the home building stocks, but I decided against it because I didn't want the karma of making money on shorting it. I was so appalled by the corruption, not just of the leadership, but the general population. And I just wanted nothing to do with the karma of the whole thing. I'd come through a process where I had been saved by a whole series of miracles. And once you've been saved by a whole series of miracles, you feel incredibly loyal to the divine source of those miracles. And the last thing you want to do is do anything to jeopardize it. So I just said, I don't want the karma. In the movie, the Deutsche Bank writes the shorts, betting against the market. Any kind of operation like that has to be approved at the very highest levels. So the idea that you had a renegade guy running around to Deutsche Bank writing billion-dollar shorts, I don't think so. Nevertheless, it's a marvelously entertaining movie, and it gives you a real peek about how scary it is when a huge market collapses. I still think that Margin Call is the best of the genre, but if you've already seen Margin Call and you want to You want to see a very interesting story about the people who were running some of the shorts. Of course, the big short was Goldman Sachs, and they didn't seem to make it into the movie. Okay, the interview with Saker. I finally finished his wonderful book. It's 600 pages long, but you can read it in a little delicious. You can break it down into chapters and read it in spurts. So I finally wrote the book review and put that up last week along with the commentary, and we published the interview tonight. It's invaluable to look through both the book and the interviews and see what they mean to you. What we did in this interview is we really said, okay, what does it mean to go from a unipolar world to a multipolar world? What does it mean to me? So Saker and I discuss that, and then he brings us up to date on what's going on in the European Union and the Middle East. His opinions differ tremendously with Don Cox, and I'm much closer to Saker in my views than I am to Don Cox, but I think the two of them make an interesting juxtaposition. Cox going up last week and taking much more of the Israeli line, and Saker taking a much more coming at it from the Brixis line. As I said, he is not a believer that the European Union is going to hold together, but it's a great interview. And again, he's going to be with us quarterly during 2016, and I'm very happy to have him. I think he's got a marvelous take on things, and I recommend his book to you highly. Okay, that's it for this week. Sorry for the length, but I really wanted to go in depth into the Panama Papers. Closing next week, we have the first quarter wrap up. We're gonna integrate. Normally, I do the wrap up and then I have Farrell come and discuss the wrap up, and then I do the quarterly equity overview. I'm gonna integrate them into one to make it much richer, denser. Our theme is where to stash your cash. I'll do that. Stories and trends. I'm going to interview Dr. Farrell next week. We spent a lot of time in the Solari team pulling and going through everything that happened in the first quarter and trying to condense it down to the top trends and stories. And I've worked through it with Dr. Farrell, and he's going to jump on and we're going to chew through it together. That's going to be a marvelous conversation, because I'll tell you, there is a lot going on. And then the quarterly equity overview I'll do, and we'll put it all together with a web presentation. And I think it'll really help you get a great overview of what's going on, see the markets clearly. We've got all the charts lined up, and then we go through the checklist of what the options are, so get some clear thinking about how to manage your cash. April 21st, Rambus is coming back with a blockbuster chartology. He's essentially going to do what he did last time again. So we'll take an in-depth look at currencies, the commodities markets, and the equity markets, a strong look at the dollar. Then on April 28th, the last week of the month, an unbelievable treat, my interview with David Talbot, The Devil's Chessboard. I did a book review of his book, The Devil's Chessboard. It's up on the website. I'm still digesting. That book is going to reverberate throughout my spirit and intellect for a long time. It is the single best book I've ever read on the Kennedy assassination. And if you want to understand American history, if you want to understand the history of covert operations in this country, if you want to understand the Kennedy years, this is really a book that I strongly recommend. It's long. It's not a short book, but it is absolutely beautifully written, and it unlocks a whole doorway to understanding the history of this country that is absolutely marvelous. So take a look at the book review. It's a great interview with David Talbot on April 28th. It's one you absolutely don't want to miss. So until next week with the first quarter wrap-up, where to stash your cash in 2016, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.